Honor.
Good morning to you. This is a petition for further review, and you're the petitioner, correct?
I am.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Nathan Sarayakoff, appearing on behalf of Travis Mitchell and the Lancaster County Public Defender's Office. This case is a case about whether a prosecutor can comment at closing argument on a defendant's silence or the lack of denial when that silence occurred after the defendant's arrest, before he was Mirandized, in a case in which he did not testify. And I know that's a little clunky to follow, but I think it's really important that you understand that there's three elements here. Whether he testified is critical in our understanding. Whether he was Mirandized, whether he was arrested. Arrest, Miranda, testimony. And I think if you look at the jurisprudence on this issue, especially the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence on this issue, you'll see six areas where this has been litigated. The Supreme Court has ruled on five of these issues. The sixth issue is our issue, the issue here we're here on today. The Supreme Court is silent on this exact issue. This court is silent on this exact issue.
This combination
of this exact issue, yes. This precise issue might be a better way of phrasing it.
Counsel, in your brief, though, for this further review, you extensively cite United States versus Moore. Do you remember that case?
I do remember that case, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
In that case, they also talk about a situation where someone on their own volunteers statements, and they address those type of situations as they get to their ultimate conclusion. In this case, your client volunteered statements on the way to the jail. So what, if any, impact does that have on this situation where your client chose to give volunteered statements?
I actually think that fact pattern creates a further problem for the state in commenting on the defendant's silence. And that's why I keep saying silence in these little quotes, because the defendant wasn't really silent in the back of that squad car. He was talking and talking about whether or not he was driving. And the prosecutor commented on whether or not he denied being drunk. And I think that the record creates this murky situation where the prosecutor commenting on whether or not he denied being drunk when the defendant wasn't really aware what he was being arrested for. The record is not clear as to what he was being arrested for or whether he was told what he was being arrested for. And in fact, from the record, it almost looks like he thought he was being arrested for just DUR, driving under revocation, as opposed to driving under influence, in which case he was uttering denials about his driving under influence and didn't think or wasn't prompted in any way to deny his driving under influence. And that makes this seriously different than the Salinas case that the United States Supreme Court most recently decided.
Counsel, I understand what you're saying, and that's an argument that the record doesn't support the argument. That's a different argument. But what about the fact that the Moore case talks about situations where a defendant waives his right to silence by volunteering statements? How does that specifically impact this case? Not whether the record supported the argument, but how does that?
Specifically, my client did not waive his right to silence after DUI. He certainly waived his right to silence for DUR, because he engaged in an argument with the police officer about whether or not he was driving under revocation. But he was silent as to DUI, and it's improper to comment on someone's silence on a charge they didn't know that they were arrested for.
So what you're saying is if someone's arrested for robbery and an assault, they could waive the right to silence as the robbery, but not as to the other charge. Is that what you're saying? You can...
No, I'm saying robbery and assault are too deeply intertwined. Driving under revocation and DUI can be committed completely separately. Robbery and assault are committed together. You have to steal and rob, or steal and assault to commit a robbery. If it was robbery and DUR and he only denied the DUR, I would totally agree with what you just said. But these are separate and distinct crimes, and my client wasn't under the impression or didn't know that he was being arrested for DUI, just DUR. He wasn't Mirandized on the DUI.
What if factually they are melded together?
In this case, they're factually melded together, but they're distinct offenses. So one can deny, I wasn't driving. You didn't catch me driving. But that doesn't mean that he ever thought that he was being arrested for being intoxicated while driving.
Well, then he's chatty about one of the elements of a DUI.
The driving element. He's saying, I'm denying driving. I wasn't driving. That's correct. But again, he's not commenting on the principal element of a DUI. I wasn't drinking. I didn't drink. He never comments as to that. And that's not that. I don't think that can be interpreted by the prosecutor, by the jury, as a failure to deny that he was drinking, given the record. I just don't think that that's a fair assertion. And I think that that creates the same kinds of problems that this court has dealt with and the Supreme Court has dealt with when it talks about it being too difficult to tease out whether or not he was denying because of what he was being asked or denying because he had not invoked the right yet. So he was in the back of the squad car, and he had not yet denied DUI, but he clearly was denying DUR. And I don't think it's fair for the prosecutor to say he didn't deny DUI, therefore he was driving drunk. Like, he was silent on DUI, and I think we should respect that silence.
So the purpose of the prosecutor's comment was to create an inference that because he had not denied that he was intoxicated, he therefore was intoxicated.
Exactly. And I think those inferences are terribly dangerous
to
the Fifth Amendment.
When the prosecutor made that statement, what did counsel do?
Counsel objected. He objected on grounds that inference had been made, and then there was a sidebar. The sidebar was recorded. The record contains the sidebar. The judge indicated to counsel that he understood and heard that the prosecutor had made that improper objection, and then he sustained a...
made the improper argument.
Improper argument, yes. And then he sustained he asked counsel whether he wanted a mistrial. Counsel at first equivocated and then said yes. Judge overruled the mistrial and instructed the jury to disregard the prosecutor's statements, which I don't think was enough.
Counsel, is that the record? He affirmatively overruled the motion for mistrial?
Yes, it is. I don't have the cite for you in my head, but it's in the record.
Okay.
So we think that the general rule that the court should follow is that the defendant's silence may not be used against him. And that's the general rule that we always have to follow. The exception to that rule is that silence can be used to impeach when the defendant chose to testify. And that's common sense.
So, so we're looking at this as an abuse of discretion case?
No.
That seems to me that if the trial court didn't grant the mistrial that you requested, then the issue is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion by not granting the mistrial.
We do think the trial court abused its discretion by not granting the mistrial, but we think that it was a fundamental violation of the defendant's constitutional rights when the prosecutor commented.
Well, that would go to the mistrial.
That's correct. The bottom line is, we don't think it's appropriate for a prosecutor to comment in its case in chief on the defendant's silence. I think the brief is clear
on that.
Counsel,
what do you have to prove to actually get this reversed on your... Because this petition for further review solely on the failure to grant a mistrial. What do you have to show us here today in order to get that?
In order to prove that there was a violation, I think you just need to look at the record. We have to show you that the Constitution was indeed violated. You would find that I can't remember the exact language. It's in our initial brief.
Don't you have to show actual prejudice?
I don't recall. I'm sorry. I'm blanking at this moment. Okay. But I know it's in my brief to the Court of Appeals. We discussed that very issue.
If you do have to show actual prejudice, could you focus some of your argument on what that might be on our record?
Yes. So actual prejudice in this case would be that the jury was told by the prosecutor that the defendant didn't deny a fundamental element of the crime that he was driving, and that they can infer then that he was driving under the influence. That seems to me to be clearly prejudicial and would have led the jury to then believe that my client admitted by not denying that he had driven under the influence, and that is actual prejudice.
Isn't it inherent in your argument that the admonishment didn't cure the prejudice?
That's exactly right. We don't think that the admonishment cured the prejudice at all.
Well, but haven't we said that ordinarily we presume that it does?
But not in these types of cases. In cases in which a right of this substance has just been admonished rather than mistrial, we can't turn back the clock on a statement like that. The prosecutor's saying he admitted to it. We can't turn back that clock.
You're
we
saying
have to
because
get a new
it's
jury.
A constitutional right.
What's that?
It's a constitutional
exactly
right,
right
at issue as opposed to some other arguably, shall I say, lesser.
That's exactly right. That's the narrowness of our brief and the memorandum brief is focusing on this is a constitutional right, and we've disregarded those other issues about whether or not there's a lesser right involved.
Wasn't the defendant's constitutional right not to testify also included in the instructions? Wasn't there a separate standard, standalone instruction on that?
Of course, there's always a standalone instruction on that. But that is not enough to remove the taint. The prosecutor said, he didn't deny this. Basically, you admitted it. That's a huge taint that can't be overcome just by a verbal warning by the judge.
Was any specific instruction requested to deal with this situation?
Trial counsel asked the court to, at the very least, and the alternative, I think, he said, at the very least, you need to advise the court not to, or advise the jury to disregard these statements.
And that's what happened.
And that's what happened. And I don't recall whether or not there was a specific instruction that was debated in the jury deliberations.
Are you arguing that the violation of a constitutional right is always prejudice that would require reversal?
I don't know that I want to go that far. But I think when you deal with a substantive constitutional right where a jury has been told, essentially, admitted to this, that taint can't be removed, is what I'm saying. I'm clearly out of time. Any further questions?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Vinson, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. I will argue here what I argued before the Court of Appeals, namely that Mitchell's statements were not silence, and the prosecutor's comments were not improper. Mitchell's claim is predicated on an exchange that occurred between Mitchell and Officer Quant after Mitchell had been arrested, but before he had been given Miranda warnings. And unfortunately, that exchange is not described in detail in my brief. But if you'll bear with me for just a moment, I will walk through it as quickly as I can. Mitchell was initially arrested in his driveway, and he was placed in the back of the patrol car. And for the first few minutes that he's back there, he's essentially arguing with Officer Quant about whether Officer Quant saw him driving. But the critical part of the exchange occurs when Mitchell asks what he's being charged with. And Officer Quant tells him, well, driving during revocation for now. And so Mitchell sits silently for a few seconds and he asks, what is it, drinking while intoxicated? And Officer Quant tells him, well, that investigation is pending. And Mitchell says, you didn't breathalyze me. And the officer says, well, the intoxilizer's in jail. And then he says, well, I wasn't in my vehicle. And then Mitchell proceeds to ask about his Miranda warnings, at which time the officer tells him, I don't have to give those to you because you're not being questioned. So eventually they arrive at the jail. Officer Quant escorts Mitchell into the jail, and he explains to him that, well, initially you were arrested for driving during revocation, or I'm going to administer this breath test, and there's a good chance you're going to be charged with DUI as well. Well, Mitchell gets agitated, and he again starts in, you didn't see me driving, I wasn't in my vehicle, you didn't see me driving. The police officer then tells him, again, you need to do the breath test. And Mitchell says, for what? You didn't see me driving. And so at that point, Officer Quant reads the post-arrest chemical test advisement. He directs him to submit to the chemical test. And Mitchell expressly and repeatedly refuses to submit to the test. So this entire exchange is captured on tape. It's offered into evidence, and it is played for the jury. During closing, the prosecutor points out that Mitchell is focused exclusively on whether he was driving and says nothing about whether he's drinking or is under the influence, and then further suggests that that's no coincidence. And now Mitchell contends that his failure to say anything about alcohol is constitutionally protected silence, which the prosecutor misused. I do not agree. What the prosecutor was trying to do here was to highlight the probative value of the statements that Mitchell did make. And when you're looking at all of the evidence that was presented at trial, the erratic driving, the alcohol containers, the physical manifestations of intoxication, the inquiry about DUI, and ultimately the refusal to submit to the chemical test, it is significant that Mitchell is not saying, I haven't been drinking or I'm not intoxicated. You have several pieces of evidence. They all fit together perfectly, and they all lead to the inevitable conclusion that Mitchell is under the influence of alcohol. So what you have here is a prosecutor drawing inferences from the evidence and arguing them to the jury, which is exactly what closing argument is for. So I see nothing improper about the prosecutor's remarks in this case.
The prosecutor's remark was focused on the verbal exchange, not conduct. That's what's on deck, right? The
yes.
Verbal exchange.
It's the verbal exchange.
Was there an objection to the offer of the tape? The statement come in?
No. I believe they had a Jackson v. Denham hearing right before trial, and it turned out the statements were voluntary, and so they were missing. I don't think he really had a valid objection.
Was there one made?
To the extent that you can consider the hearing itself an objection, if you tried to move to get those excluded, if they were voluntary, they're coming in. So I don't believe there was a specific objection at trial. But even if the prosecutor's comment...
Counsel, are you familiar with the Moore case cited by the... appellant here?
From the D.C. Circuit.
From where?
It's from the D.C. Circuit,
correct.
1997. Yes, I've read it.
Okay. In there they talk about situations where someone's is silent throughout the whole process, and then they differentiate that with situations where someone makes volunteer statements, as here. How does that affect this case, if any?
Well, I think the statements came in, and from my perspective, the point is the statements were voluntary, they came in, and now the question is what inferences can be reasonably drawn from the statements that he did make. I don't really see how we get to silence in this case, and I think that keeping in mind that case was like 1997, and we have since had Salinas v. Texas come out where the court has reiterated. I mean, they said as early as 1980 in the United States v. Roberts that the privilege against self-incrimination is not self-executing. And outside the context of a custodial interrogation, you have to invoke it if you choose to avail yourself of that privilege. And so here, I've got him making statements. I don't have him ever at any time invoking the privilege. I'm not sure how we get to silence or saying you can't use this for any purpose.
Let's say hypothetically it was an improper comment, just hypothetically.
Sure.
The argument from other counsel seems to be that any time you violate a constitutional right involving right to silence, it shows actual prejudice. How would you address that argument?
I believe that's incorrect. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe all constitutional errors are subject to harmless error analysis. Are not subject to harmless error analysis or structural errors. Which leads into my next point, which is I think that even if the comments here were improper, there is no prejudice. I mean, he objected to the comments, the district court sustained the objection, and gave a curative instruction, which was in itself sufficient to dispel any potential prejudice. But beyond that, any error was most certainly harmless because the evidence of his guilt was overwhelming. He had virtually no chance of being acquitted.
Does it make sense to equate silence as to an element with silence as to the crime?
I'm not sure I understand.
Can the prosecutor say this defendant was silent on an element, but not say the defendant was silent as to the crime?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what happened in the United States v. Frazier case. Which was the Eighth Circuit case that the Court of Appeals relied on, and that was a situation where it was a drug interdiction case. They found a bunch of 4 million pseudoephedrine pills in the back of this trailer, and the prosecutor, they went up and confronted the driver and the passenger and said, well, you're under arrest. He doesn't say anything. So when the prosecutor says, well, he's not angry, he's not surprised, he's not combative, and the reason that he was offering it was on the element of knowledge, which was something that they had to prove in that case. So it went to a specific element.
On the Eighth Circuit case, did that involve impeachment?
No. It was offered as substantive evidence to prove an element of the offense.
Substantive. Did the defendant testify?
No, I don't believe he did.
Thank you.
But in short, we believe the comments, the prosecutor's comments were not improper, but even if they were, there was no prejudice, and for those reasons, we would ask that the judge appeal.
Before you sit down,
sure.
The state's position is perhaps oversimplistically that he waived his right to silence by talking.
I think what I'm saying is that these statements were voluntary. They came into evidence, and now it's just a question of arguing.
Okay.
I don't really see this as silence at all, but to the extent that he had a right to silence, he never invoked it and arguably waived it by making statements.
Okay.
But the comment that we're considering is not that he said, I didn't drive. It's that he did not say, I did not drink.
Exactly, but there is absolutely no ambiguity as to what that sentence means when you consider it within the larger context of all the evidence presented at trial. I mean, I think you can fairly infer from the record in this case that Mr. Mitchell understood that he was under the influence of alcohol. He knew that he was. He also knew the only way he was going to get out from underneath this DUI is if the officers didn't catch him driving. And that, you look at the erratic driving at the beginning when he takes off from the Home Depot, he's got the lumber hanging off of his car. He's speeding, he's passing people on the turn lane, and then he blows through a red light. But the reason he wants to get home so fast is because he knows he's revoked, he's drunk, he's not supposed to be driving. And then you have all of these focused on, well, he didn't see me driving, he didn't see me driving.
So that all goes to the prejudice, if improper, not prejudicial?
Right. I don't think there's any prejudice, but I think you can infer. I mean, I don't know that we would treat statements different than any other piece of evidence when you're talking about piecing a circumstantial case together.
There's a no statement. There's a no statement comment here.
Right. But sometimes what people don't say, and I think that's what the court said in Salinas v. Texas, is sometimes silence is probative on the issue of guilt, and so it may be admissible. And I mean, I guess I could, I didn't research this very much, but I did do a quick search. There was a California Supreme Court case from 2014 called People v. Tom, and the site is 331 Pacific 3rd 303, where the California Supreme Court addressed that issue head on. It was a situation where a prosecutor was relying at trial on some certain things that the defendant did not say. And so they squarely addressed that issue, and they go through all of the Supreme Court case law. They recognize the split in the federal circuits. They cite to some other state courts, and they basically come to the conclusion that unless the defendant has unambiguously invoked his right to remain silent, his silence can be used against him, but with the caveat that the rules of evidence might work to keep it out, that there may be instances in which silence really is...
Are you saying that the defense counsel has to put his client on the stand and ask him if he wishes to testify, and the client then has to invoke his right under the Fifth Amendment not to testify?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay, so what if the defendant is picked up for murder and he denies that he owned the gun, but he doesn't ever deny that he killed the person or that he shot the victim?
Well, then
can the prosecution then say, well, all he commented on was that he didn't own the gun. He never told us that he didn't shoot the victim. Is that a fair comment that the prosecution can make?
Well, no, unless you have to have other evidence. I mean, these are as with all constitutional violations or alleged constitutional, they all turn on their specific facts. They're highly context-specific.
Well, you may have other evidence, but you can't comment on the fact that the defendant didn't deny it and didn't testify.
All right, well, let me give you an example. In this case, if they had told them, hey, you're under arrest for DUI, they put him in the back of the cruiser, he doesn't say a word, and then the prosecutor gets up at trial and says, well, we told him he was under the influence of alcohol, or he was under arrest for a DUI, and he didn't deny it, ergo he's guilty. Do I think that's proper? No. And I think that's a question where you say, hey, this silence simply isn't probative. You can't bring it in. I mean, I'm not saying that this is just an open-ended,
Well, what if all he said was, you didn't catch me driving? And then the prosecutor comments on the fact, well, he didn't deny that he was drunk, therefore he must be drunk.
That's true, but that's not the situation that we have here, and that's complicated by the fact that he wasn't arrested just for DUI, he was arrested for DUR, and I believe that's what he was told at the outset. So when he's initially in the cruiser with the officer quibbling about whether he caught him driving, that could have very well been cabined to that excuse, to that one thing. But once he, on his own, says, what's the charge? Is it drinking while intoxicated? He's now injected it. You're wondering, well, why are you asking about DUI when I haven't even told you that you're under arrest for DUI? And then you start talking about the breathalyzer, and now all of a sudden the complexion of this has changed because he knows we're talking about DUI. He's being asked to submit to a breath test, and he's saying, I'm not going to do it. because you didn't catch me driving. Not because I'm not under the influence, which is something that you might reasonably expect someone to say in that situation. Why would you want me to take a breath?
Does it matter that this is the trial for DUI? Pardon me.
Well, it's for both. He stipulated to the DUR.
He's still seeking an inference that because he didn't deny it, he was drunk.
Exactly, but that's a permissible inference based on all of the evidence that was presented at trial. You can't just divorce these statements from their context, look at them and say, well, gee, that looks improper.
But even if we disagree, the trial court told the jury to disregard it.
That's correct. And again, I think the evidence that's held is overwhelming here.
I'm sorry, what was the jury told about the driving while revoked?
They stipulated that his license was revoked, and there was really no dispute that he was driving. He was seen by multiple people.
What? Was the jury informed that driving while revoked was a count in the case?
Yeah, I believe both counts went to the jury.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He is over.
We have no time for rebuttal, so that concludes arguments for today. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.